Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another Red Sox Hot Stove edition of the Bastards of Boston Baseball. Tonight, we'll actually probably not get into much Hot Stove, actually. We're going to discuss the possible vulnerability of Alex Cora coming off of, well, one bad season. 2021 wasn't pretty for a little while, and so we're gonna get into that, what his status might be if the team underperforms again. And Cody Paulson with me tonight. Cody, how are you?
Terry, I'm doing well. Happy to be back on the pod. Good to see everybody. Hopefully everybody had a good weekend. A lot of good sports action to catch up on. I don't know if you have any tennis fans out there, but the Australian Open is starting this Sunday. So that'll, you know, make the mornings a little bit more interesting for those that are interested.
You're a tennis guy?
Big time tennis guy. That was actually nice. My sport growing up in parallel with baseball.
Wow. Okay. So I was kind of big into tennis probably in the mid to late 2000s. And I liked Andy Roddick, and he only won, obviously, his one major. Wasn't great. I mean, he was the best American player, I think, for a while, wasn't he?
Oh, hands down. He was at least my favorite American, if not my favorite tennis player. I was always a Rafa Nadal guy myself. And you could argue, I mean, had Federer not been there, Roddick's career looks a whole lot different, right? There were so many, you know, semifinals or finals where Roddick would breeze through the tournament and then, you know, just get his doors blown off by Roger. But Roddick was definitely, you know, really exciting to watch, play with a lot of flair, a lot of energy. And as an American too, you know, that just made it all the better.
Yeah. And, you know, because Sampras was one of the best American, you know, tennis players of all time. And he was, you know, throughout the 90s. And so Roddick, I was always, his interviews were the best, I think, you know, especially if it wasn't a great match and then he was super candid. I always admired the character, and, you know, he played with such intensity and almost won the 2009 Wimbledon matchup versus Federer. Yeah.
Yeah. That volley, I think, you know, I imagine he still has some sleepless nights about it. Yeah. Unfortunately.
Tennis is one of those sports where none of the athletes are really unlikable. I feel like.
No. Yeah, I mean, there's a few here and there where they kind of get branded with that label early on in their careers, and they have a hard time coming back. But for the most part, everybody's just like nice, polished, knows what to say the right things, doesn't do a lot of, you know, for lack of better terms, showmanship in the bad direction on the court. And, you know, you just kind of keep it moving. There's not a lot of animosity.
Yeah, I mean, Federer, Nadal, just super classy. Yeah. Djokovic obviously has had his off the court controversies, but, you know, typically, you know, pretty mild mannered. And so you don't really get the controversy you might get in other sports, but.
Correct.
Yeah. My weird sport, I've said it before, is NASCAR. You know, I grew up on it. My family just really big into it, but. Yeah. All right. Well, I don't think the audience, we don't want to lose them because this is a baseball podcast. And I think probably maybe 5% of them are tennis fans. So let's just get into that. So we're going to talk about Alex Cora. And I think this is kind of more relevant than people might think because Bloom's on the hot seat. And what's something that happens when the top executive is on the hot seat? You know, usually the manager goes in a last ditch effort and, you know, to hopefully shake things up. And Cora's been here longer, you know, maybe ownership might have a say in it. But at this point, seeing what we've seen from Alex Cora, he's obviously not a bad manager by any means, but is he a make or break guy? Like, is he a guy that the Red Sox absolutely have to retain at all costs? Or is it possible that maybe a new voice, should the team not, you know, thrive this year, could be beneficial going forward.
I think you teed it up tremendously, right? You started with the hot stove episodes, hot stove off season, and then you transitioned right into the hot seat, right? You
know, it's the hot seat episode.
There you go. If I'm Alex Cora, my seat's a little bit warm. And I'll say all of this with the caveat that I was never a super big Alex Cora guy, even when they made a manager back in, I believe, what is after 2017 is when we officially, appointed him to the helm. Obviously, he pushed all the right buttons. You look at, pinch hitting, Nunez for Devers, and, Nunez goes deep for a three-run bomb in the division series, and we just kind of get off and rolling, and, we roll all the way through the postseason. 108 wins, most wins in Red Sox history. I've never looked at him as the kind of guy that took us over the edge so much as he's the guy that didn't make any unnecessary mistakes. I'm also, it's weird that he's been here for what, give or take 3 to 5 years, considering he got fired for a year, came back. He's never had what I would consider like a middle of the road team to manage. And then we can really get an understanding of how good he is as a manager, right? His first season, we had arguably one of the most talented Red Sox teams of all time. And every button he pushed worked the right way. You brought in a guy for an extra inning, worked out, three shot, no damage. Or, he pinched hit, the guy got the knock, or he moved the runner over. There was some sort of positive outcome. You're not left with Alex Cora wondering, why did he make this decision, or was this a boneheaded play? But at the same time, you never really feel like you go into a game with a manager advantage per se, right? We get the benefit of going against Aaron Boone 19 times a season, which is, at least a half a run advantage. Granted, their roster has been a little bit hardier than ours in some seasons past, but you have a COVID season. You have a season in which we don't have any starters or any bullpen help. And, Alex has to figure out a way, how can I get 27 outs with guys that can't throw a ball over the plate? So we haven't, it's really weird place to be 5 seasons in, or 3, or however you want to count it, and not have a true pulse on how he is as a manager. I think the most we can judge him on is how does he manage his clubhouse? How does he manage the guys? What is the attitude of the players? And, it's a pretty tight ship operation in the clubhouse. We don't get a lot of reports out. We don't get a lot of quotes or a lot of storylines. But when we started making some moves at the trade deadline, or, we DFA'd Plawecki, a lot of the guys kind of shut it down and started pouting. And Cora kind of, I don't want to say backed them or supported them or continued that thought or that mantra, but it doesn't really seem like he has that resilience or that fire that says, hey guys, look, this is a business, or this is a team. We still had to put those 25 guys out, 9 guys up. Let's go get some outs. Let's go get some runs. Let's put together something. And I've never been a guy that's been the super proponent of Cora. And I don't think he's done anything in his time here to really sway, my opinion of that per se. Terry, what are your thoughts?
You make a lot of good points, and it just seems like he's not tough enough when you kind of want him to be tough. And 2018, obviously amazing, and I think the clubhouse just not having John Farrell in there, just that alone was a big, a big boost to the morale, because he had really lost, the clubhouse in his last year and a half. And so I think that was kind of helpful. But you look at 2019, we basically had the same team, as 2018. I'm trying to think of anyone we lost, but
it was just Steve Pierce. Right?
No, I think we had Steve Pierce, actually. He was just hurt for most of the year. You basically had everybody. And, the Alex Cora diehards will say, well, you lost Chris Sale and you lost David Price towards the end of the season. True, but we weren't in it before that anyway. We were grinding the whole year. And so that, there was some underperformance there. 2021, we got off to a great start, was leading the division pretty handily, and then slowly we kind of pissed it away, and we got hot for a week and a half in October, as I've pointed out quite often. And then you had this year, and I think he's just super lax. I hate that he's really aggressive with giving guys off, days off. People always say, well, you know, you gotta be fresh when you get to October, but you gotta get to October too, is part of the problem. And I want to see a little bit of toughness out of him. The only time I've seen him get after a player was Erod in the playoffs in 2021 when he did the tapping of his wrist, mock, I guess, Carlos Correa, who would do the same thing because it was Correa's time. He would say, it's my time. Mm-hmm. And I didn't like how Cora got on him for that because I like that type of gamesmanship. You know, rivalries are good. It fires teams up. And you look at the Francona run, which was 8 years, and we had some epic comebacks, you know, down 3-0 in the ALCS. Only team to ever come back from that to win the series by winning 4 games in a row. And then in 2007, it was almost similar with the then Indians, now Guardians. We won the first game of the series, then we lost 3 straight. Then we had to win 3 straight. And it just seemed like they would always play for Francona. And I've heard these stories. Some people think Francona is a little lax, but Dustin Pedroia told a story how early in his career, there was a runner on third and he tried to steal second base. And Francona was irate when he got back to the dugout because he's like Big Poppy's hitting right behind you. You know, why would you get the third out of the inning and take away the chance for him to drive in runs? And so I think quietly behind the scenes, Francona could be tough. You just don't hear of that. You don't get stories from Chris Cotillo and Pete Abraham saying Alex Cora threw a fit in the clubhouse last night about this or that. Like, I want to hear that. I want to know that the manager of our baseball team will get tough, and you just don't see it. It's just super lax, and it's just the team has never performed well in the second half outside of 2018. There's been no epic comebacks. There's been no magic. And you look at other managers like Craig Counsell. He gets the Brewers in the playoffs all the time. He gets so much out of, you know,
far less.
Yeah. Kevin Cash in Tampa does as well. I'm just thinking off the fly. I mean, the Cardinals, well, they actually have gone through some managers, but Mike Schilt was very popular for a couple of years. Took over for Mike Matheny after he got fired, and then the team went on this epic run and into the playoffs. So I don't think he's special. And I think his voice has gotten stale. So, you know, if it's mid-June and we're like 5 games under 500, I hope he's gone. I hope Heim Bloom, you know, he's got to shoot his shot and try to salvage the second half with a fresh voice. And we saw that last year. You know, Joe Maddon got fired. That one didn't do any good. Trying to think who took over for him. The Yankees third base coach, Phil Nevin, was, I'm sorry. I'm glad he...
Shocker, that didn't go better.
He's just not a guy I would want managing my baseball team. But, you know, the Phillies fired Girardi. Look what happened. Is it Kevin Thompson? I already forget his full name. His last name's Thompson. But they go all the way to the World Series. The Blue Jays fired Charlie Montoyo, and then again, his name's escaping me, but they're with their bench coach. They get into the playoffs. Had a bit of a choke job there against the Mariners, but they righted the ship to get into the postseason. So I think that precedent will possibly lead to more firings this year, and it wouldn't surprise me if Alex Cora is one of them.
You brought up an interesting point about the only time he's really gotten on a player, at least publicly that we know of, being E-Rod, you know, with the wrist tapping in the ALCS, of which we promptly got swept and shown the door rudely at the end of that series, pretty much immediately thereafter. Cora has an interesting managerial technique, and we'll call it that for lack of better terms. We obviously don't know those player-only meetings or what I said behind closed doors, but he seems to find one of the few consistent producers of the teams and makes a vendetta against them, right? Like, for a stretch there, E-Rod was one of our more consistent pitchers, one of our more reliable guys, one of our better performers, and, you know, he would go and throw a quality start, and Cora would be like, yeah, it was mediocre, you know, we'd really like to see E-Rod be better, you know, with his pitch count or something like that, you know, where the other guys can only go four innings, five innings or whatever it was, and you wouldn't hear anything about it. And lately, we're getting the same kind of treatment out of Verdugo. You know, this team, let's call it what it was poor last year. And Verdugo was one of the few guys that had spark, had energy, had charisma, produced better than most, I would like to say, a table setter, a guy that could come up with a big knock. And Cora's out here roasting him in the media, in the press conferences, saying, you know, we expect more out of him. We really need to see him turn the corner and start carrying a bigger load on this team. And I don't think, you know, it's not Verdugo's role on this team to be that guy that you're going to bat third that needs to have 100, you know, RBIs, 25 round trippers or whatever it is. He's supposed to be the guy that could score 100 runs, get on base, you know, have long at bats, set the table, play good defense, and be the energy guy, which I think is a much better role for him. And so it's also, you know, on the heels of us not really having anything tangible to say, hey, he's done this well, for him to go out of his way to pick the couple of guys that are producing and make up a narrative against them, to me is a super unique way of leading.
Another excellent point, you know, and E-Rod's always been a big game guy, you know, always pitched well against the Yankees, especially in Yankee Stadium. It takes a unique individual to be able to do that under immense pressure, and he always seemed to. For whatever reason, against the Orioles in July, you know, that might not go well for E-Rod, but yeah, and he pitched well, and his performance in the 2018 World Series, he was a spot starter for, what was it, game four. I think Eovaldi would have pitched that game had he not gone into extras. I think he pitched, what, six innings of extras, and so E-Rod became the starter. And ironically, Cora screwed him because Puig had hit Rodriguez, I think, pretty hard earlier in the game, and then there it was, the sixth or seventh inning, Puig coming back up. Cora should not have left E-Rod in there, and Puig crushes him. And yeah, so, but Moreland bailed us out, and, you know, so E-Rod, at a minimum, held down the fort that game in a very big spot. And yeah, and then you get to Verdugo. You know, say what you want about, you know, playing in the field and whatnot, but in the lineup, He was the most consistent guy last year, and he was hitting wherever Cora put him. You know, I think he was in the five hole for a good part of the year and had to get moved up, you know, towards the top of the lineup as guys were getting hurt, particularly Trevor Story. And here's an amazing stat to me. In 593 at-bats, he struck out 86 times. That's it. You know, there's guys striking out, you know, in the upper hundreds, some of them still touching 200, and just one of the better guys at the plate, one of the better at-bats on the team. And I was a little surprised to see that there was some criticism toward Verdugo, you know, and some of the other guys were slumping bad. I mean, JD had a bad second half, and Devers went through these stretches where he would just be swinging for the fences and where he could have been putting together, you know, better at bats to, you know, to just move the base runners along and whatnot. But yeah, so interesting. And I know I've been beating the drum to trade Verdugo because I just think we're so lefty heavy. And I think you could get back something serviceable for him.
I mean, out of all of the positions in which we could afford to lose a guy of value, I think Verdugo is one of those guys that you could circle. Like you mentioned, he's lefty heavy. He plays good defense. You know, he's a good clubhouse guy from, you know, what we know, at least, right? It's obviously so tough to be able to stake a claim on if they're a good clubhouse guy or not. But I think you're right. You absolutely could get value for somebody like Verdugo. Would I be bummed to see him leave? Absolutely. You know, but if the return is good enough, who else on our team can we say, like, hey, we can actually get something of value back? And I think he's one of the few guys for a lot of the reasons that you had just mentioned.
Yeah. I just feel like four lefties in the lineup is just asking for trouble because Yoshida's going to play every day. So will Devers. So will Casas. You know, so he's just unfortunately expendable, but still a guy that really I don't think got enough credit for how good offensively he was last season. Let's see here. So if it happens, let's say Alex Cora, you know, fired at some point during the season, who do you think the manager will be at that point? Ramon Vasquez is the bench coach.
I don't like the idea of burning that bullet too early and just immediately promoting him to interim manager, because then, you know, say the team gets hot and goes on a run, or, you know, the team was well positioned to go on a run, then we're stuck with, well, is, you know, Vasquez a good manager? Should we keep him at the helm? Should we move him back to the bench coach and get in an outside voice? And this could be biased growing up, you know, a burgeoning Red Sox fan in the late 90s, early 2000s, obviously falling in love with Tech, you know, the captain. I think he'd be the perfect guy to have as the interim tag, right? You know, kind of a, I don't want to bring Jeff Saturday in and make them comparables because they're definitely not, but a guy that has a lot of respect with the guys in the locker room. You know, obviously Tech's career didn't share any time with the guys that are, you know, in the clubhouse now, but somebody that they can look up to, they can say, hey, like, I remember when you played for this team, when you wore this uniform, you know, knows the pressures of playing in Boston. And it can give him the chance to get his feet wet as a manager without there being, you know, it necessarily an audition per se, right? Because I think the only knock that you have against Tech at this point is he doesn't have that experience, or maybe he doesn't want to be a manager. And that's the reason he hasn't gotten more looks or more interviews per se. So if you were able to get him there in there, you know, if it's the back end of the first half or even the entire of the second half, you get to see how you perform, how he handles the pressure, how he handles the clubhouse, how he handles the media. And, you know, it gives you an idea to say, like, hey, this is somebody that we've got in the chamber if we want to go down that path in the future, but we're not necessarily forced to. I think if you promote the bench coach, then you put yourself in a position where you started that clock maybe a little bit earlier than you necessarily wanted to. And now you're stuck with, man, you know, he was our interim. He did well. We either got to keep him or he's going to go be a manager somewhere else. Or, man, you know, he didn't do well. And now we can't kind of demote him back to the bench coach because he's gotten the taste of manager. Or he doesn't want, you know, the public humiliation of being, quote unquote, demoted, even though it might not necessarily be a real demotion. And I think it just gets a little bit messier when you put the next person in line up for interim if you don't have a better plan.
I agree. I think Jason Varitek is the more logical choice. And I mean, he's done enough behind the scenes now. I mean, he is qualified to do it. And, you know, he was a leader as a player, you know, the last official Red Sox team captain. But additionally to all that, I mean, if you're Chaim Bloom and your image is in the mud, you know, with the fan base, and you're just getting thrashed every day on social media, sometimes by the local beat writers, sometimes by the national beat writers, and you want to try to save face and win back some points, you install Jason Veritek as the interim manager. Like, that's the move, I think. That's how you appease some of the fan base. And if he's the type of guy that can right the ship, and you do have that Phillies effect from 2022, or even the Blue Jays, who again went on to make the playoffs, I think that's the type of move that can save your ass. I really do. And Jason Veritek right now is the game planning coordinator. And what that basically means is it's his job to figure out how our pitchers are going to attack the hitters. So I'm assuming, like, if, you know, Bo Bichette on the Blue Jays is susceptible to the slider down and in, you know, Veritek's going to be, you know, conveying that to whoever the starter is for that day. You know, so stuff like that. So that's a very critical role, really, you know, even though he's not at the forefront, you know, he's not the most visible guy in the dugout, but yeah. And the other thing too, some people say, you know, well, Veritek doesn't really want to be the manager. He's happy with his cushy, you know, smaller role. I don't agree with that, because I forget if it was the 2020 offseason when Cora was let go, or if it was the next season while, you know, Bloom went through this process with some candidates, interviewed them. Sam Fold was the finalist. It came down to him and Alex Cora. So I don't know if it was that offseason or the year before when Renicky got it, but Veritek's wife was basically getting testy on social media, saying, well, you know, why wouldn't my husband get a chance or something? Maybe she said it in not so many words, but she was basically indicating that, you know, he would do it if given the opportunity. So I think he would. And I think that would be his best chance, because let's say Cora keeps his job through the season, loses it at the end, and then Bloom gets fired. The new GM, or, you know, chief baseball officer, they're going to probably want their own guy. And
you see it every time.
Yeah, most of the time they get their wish. Bloom didn't, and, you know, Cora was still kind of riding the high of that 2018 season. So, you know, Bloom had no choice but to go with Cora. But I think Veritek is pretty logical, you know, especially for where Bloom's at. And I'd love to see it, even if he's only the interim manager for the second half and then isn't kept. I would like to see what it looks like having Jason Veritek in that role, and then seeing the post-game press conferences with Jason Veritek, you know. And another thing, too, about Tech, I don't know why he's not lured away by other teams.
Maybe teams just think that he's a lifer, he's not picking up the phone, or, like you mentioned, maybe he's just more comfortable with the roles and routines that he's established here in Boston, right? You know, as much as we hear, oh, it'd be a great fit for this person if they went there, you know, do they think it's a good fit for them as well, right? Because you only do get but so many chances at jobs like this. And if you fumble the first one, maybe that phone stops ringing.
Yeah, I'm just trying to pull up his age right now. Let's see, I got it right here. 1972. So he'll be actually 51 in April. So that's fairly young for, you know, an MLB manager. And I think for a little while there was a kick with, you know, GM saying we got to get someone younger because they identify more with the current players. But I think that's kind of gone in reverse now, because you see Brian Snitker, who's in his mid to late 60s, winning a World Series. Buck Showalter, very popular hire. Unfortunately, the Mets bats fell flat in the postseason, but very good manager. Rob Thompson, that was his name. I said Kevin Thompson earlier. I think it is Rob Thompson. He's in his like mid-50s, so he's, you know, I guess fairly young, but there are some older ones. I got to be missing one or two. But another name real quick before we wrap up. I was so mad when Dombrowski didn't fire Farrell at the end of 2015. And I get that the optics would have been bad because he was undergoing cancer, but he was well on his way to losing his job before that. And then the next season, he has the opportunity to fire him again after we get swept by Cleveland, doesn't do it. And then we lost Lovello to the Diamondbacks.
Arizona? Yeah.
Exactly. I was a big Lovello guy because when you go back to the season before in 2015, we were the best team in baseball in August and September. Like, we went on a run, and it was just so fun watching that team thrive under him. It just seemed like a no-brainer, at least after 2016, to because you were going to lose him if you kept if you kept John Farrell into 2017, you're losing Lovello to another team. That's just how it works, and that's exactly what happened. I was so mad. And one of my favorite moments from that 2015 season, we were playing the Mets in Queens, and it looked like we were on the verge of blowing the game because the bullpen wasn't holding it. And we had this guy, his name was Gene Michi. We pulled him off the scrap heap halfway through the season because we needed bodies. And he wasn't great, and he was struggling out there. And Lovello walked to the top of the dugout steps. He had his hands on his hips, and he was just peering into Michi, and as if to say, you're going to get us out of here. I'm not coming out to get you. You're getting yourself out of this. And you didn't see that with Farrell. Farrell had the quickest hook ever and was extremely tentative, and his bullpen moves weren't always great, you know, especially if a guy just... He'd go to Barnes, and Barnes had looked like crap for the longest time and would have bad numbers against whoever it was he was about to face. And, you know, and there was always a better option. And Farrell just was stubbornly set in his ways. And you know, Lovello was the opposite. And he's a guy I wouldn't mind. I mean, he's had some good years in Arizona, and they're a small market team. And
I was going to say, I mean, he's done a respectable job in a place where it's tough to win in a division that's not the easiest. He's scrapped together some pretty good seasons.
Yeah. So that's another name I would love to have. But Mike Hazen is their GM out there, and he was basically the number two under Dombrowski for a little while. And I think he and Lovello just have a great relationship, and even though Lovello's not done great, he's just not under serious pressure out there because they're not that kind of a team and whatever. Mm-hmm. But if he were to ever come back to Boston, I would love that. Yeah. John Farrell's this like lobster boat captain. He has this massive vessel. I read an, there's an article and pictures of it, and he's got a crew of guys, and I'm pretty sure it's lobstering that he does, but yeah, so he's doing his thing. So I guess we can wrap on that. It'll be interesting to see because you got, like we said, Cora on the hot seat, Bloom on the hot seat. How will Bloom react to that if things aren't going well? And I don't know. Where are you at with the team real quick? Like, are they a playoff team or has that ship sailed?
You know, there's been a lot of turnover with our team currently. We're slotting in a lot of new guys that are getting injured, obviously, with the Story news. You know, everybody's got their opinions on that. I'd like to see the team at least, you know, throw a pitch, report to spring training, get some at-bats against real pitchers before I make a prediction. As it's currently constructed, if I were to make the projections strictly based off of names in the lineup, I don't see it. I would love to be proved wrong. But as it's currently constructed, I don't think we have the depth, nor do we have the upper end talent to compete in the AL East day in and day out and scrap together enough wins to squeak into the playoffs.
Let me read this just before we go off, because if I don't on this episode, I never will. Trying to get to my...
Well, while you're doing that, I do find it interesting, and you know, maybe I'm following the wrong people, or I'm not plugged into the right communities. But as negative as the media that covers the Red Sox is, it is strange that we have never heard a single peep about, you know, should Cora be let go, or should there be a change at the, you know, the top of the steps. I haven't seen any articles about it. I haven't seen any tweets. I haven't seen anybody lamenting his performance or his decisions. So that's pretty interesting from my point of view, per se.
That's a great observation. And do you know what Stockholm syndrome is?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what it is. I think the beat writers just become accustomed to him because they got to interview him every day, definitely after the game, and probably, you know, daily before the game. So there's a relationship there, and they don't want to alienate him. And even like after the final game of the 2017 season ended, which was a playoff game against Houston, I think they beat us 3-1 in the ALDS. It was painfully obvious that Farrell was about to be fired, but you had guys like Rob Bradford like making the case that he should come back. He deserves to keep his job, and it just doesn't seem to matter how bad it gets. You know, you'll have the Shaughnessys calling for it because they're not in the clubhouse, and mm-hmm. and I love Shaughnessy. I'm not criticizing him, but that's just how it works. But yeah, well, here we go. Just for like the division, I asked you if you know, if you think we're, you know, we're a playoff team or not. Here's the 1-2-3 for every AL East team, starting pitchers. They're 1, they're 2, and they're 3. Here's the Yankees. Gerrit Cole, Carlos Rodon, Nestor Cortez. Pretty good. Not bad. Here's the Blue Jays. Alek Manoah, Kevin Gausman, and Bassett. What's Bassett's first name? Man, I'm just spacing it tonight. Chris Bassett, yeah. So Alek Manoah, Kevin Gausman, Chris Bassett for the Blue Jays. Not bad. And their 4-5 is pretty good, by the way. You know,
they got
Barrios.
Swap out a guy there and be fine.
Yeah, they got Barrios under there. And then here's the Rays. I was thinking the Rays, this might be the year they fall off a little bit. That's what I was thinking. But I forgot about Glasnow. I forgot he's back and he's recovered. He might be on an innings limit, but Tampa's funky anyway. But so you got Shane McClanahan, Tyler Glasnow, and Drew Rasmussen, who had like a 2.94 ERA last year.
Blows gas.
Yeah. And then the Orioles, finally, they're not scary. They got Creamer, Wells, and Kyle Gibson. And then the Red Sox, we've got Chris Sale, James Paxton, Corey Kluber. You could switch any of them out with Pivetta if you want to, but I don't think it's going to help. That's just where we're at. The rest of the division is, not only are they better in the rotation, they're better in the lineup, you know? So, man, I'm just so frustrated. But all right, on that note, we will wrap. I'm assuming there probably will be a move this week. So hopefully no later than Wednesday or Thursday, we can come on and cover that. If not, we can always find an excuse, though. So everyone have a good start to your week. Today, for you guys, it's MLK Day, so perhaps you might have the day off and you'll listen on Tuesday, but nonetheless, have a great start to your week. Take care.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.